Hey everyone, it's Johnny. I have a special announcement. This Sunday, April 29th at Hotel Vegas, 1500 East 6th Street in Austin, Texas at 7 p.m., we'll be recording a very special edition of How Did I Get Here? A live How Did I Get Here? My guest will be Danny Malone. We'll sit down and talk at 7, and when we're done, his band will take the stage and play a set. So come on out this Sunday, April 29th. Now let's get down. Starting to get hot in Texas. If you don't live here, be glad. If you do live here, I'm sorry, but I'm with you 100%, man. This is it blows. It blows. It's all hot. You walk out to your car, you come back, you're all like, ugh. It's all sweaty and disgusting. And what do you know? How are you doing where you are? This is Johnny, I'm your host. I don't know if I've even said that yet. So it's a hot day here in Texas, and tonight I'm gonna go see. There's a comedy festival here in Austin tonight. I'm gonna go to the Moon Tower Comedy Festival and watch Marc Maron, who I like a lot. I like his podcast, WTF. And what else? I'm going to play in Houston tomorrow, which is Friday the 27th, with Skyrocket at the House of Blues. Should be fun. We're doing a couple of things there. And then I'm coming back Sunday and doing that live thing with Danny Malone. Should be a lot of fun. Real quick, before we get into today's show, I need to pay some bills. So here's an ad. Today's episode of How Did I Get Here is brought to you by Hotel Vegas, 1500 East 6th Street in Austin, Texas. Tonight, Thursday, April 26th at 9 p.m., the Boxing Lesson 7-inch vinyl release party with Purple and Paper Threat and High Tones. Boxing Lesson have been guests on the show. We had a great talk during the South by Southwest, and it was very funny and humorous. Had some cocktails. Tomorrow night, Friday, April 27th, at Hotel Vegas, rock the catwalk with Aveda for Clean Water with KP and the Boom Boom. And on Saturday, April 28th, at 9 p.m., Stanley and In Too Deep. That show starts at 9 p.m. Then, of course, Sunday, April 29th, Hotel Vegas, live How Did I Get Here interview. I'll be interviewing Danny Malone at 7 p.m. And then the band follows at I don't know what time. There's a $5 cover. Doors are at 6. Come on out. Come on out. Just come on out. Live podcast recording. Come on out to Hotel Vegas anyway. Have a drink. Look them up. Hotel Vegas. I think it's hotelvegasaustin.com. They got a bunch of shows coming up next week. Graham Wilkinson, John Branch Band, Tiger Named Lovesick, Neil Young Hoot Night. Got Hoot Nights coming up. What? All right, you guys, on with the show. All right, so my guest today is musician Jess Klein. She's a singer-songwriter. She lives here in Austin. She's from Boston and New York and all these kind of places. I met Jess quite a few years ago at a birthday party for Patty Griffin that she reminded me of on an email that we were exchanging setting this up. And, I met her since then. I've seen her play. I've always thought she's really, really good, man, really talented. And she's always seemed really nice. And today she came over. And I interviewed her, and it was fantastic. I really enjoyed talking to her, and her new album, Behind a Veil, is really amazing. I've been listening to it all morning and kind of like immersing myself in Jess Klein world. So I'm really glad she came over. I'm really glad I got to meet her. She's a really interesting person, very funny, and has a good outlook on life. I like that in people, right? So I guess without further ado, here's my guest for today, Jess Klein.
The gypsy looking to her crystal ball in her shop out on the boardwalk, where she probably tells them all, you will meet a handsome stranger, it will be a lightning bolt from above. I don't need another jolt, dear, just tell me this is love.
your mama. Like looking at all your artwork.
I know.
Cool.
A lot of it is my girlfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's amazing.
That's cool.
Yeah. She even got my dogs to paint me paintings with their paws.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's Jess, great.
How you doing, Jess Klein?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. You just put out that album Behind a Veil. Sorry, I just took a drink at the beginning. I'm so pro. That's how Tom Brokaw does it.
Yeah.
You just put out this album Behind a Veil.
Right.
And you had some significant changes in your life over the last year, which I was reading in your bio.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
It is, yeah. It's so official.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is an album that is a direct result of a personally challenging 2011 for Jess.
That's true.
Tell me about it.
Well, March of last year, my dad passed away of ALS, and he had been, you know, sick for about 5 years, so it wasn't a big shock, but it was a big shock because nothing really prepares you for losing a parent. And
That's Lou Gehrig's disease,
Lou Gehrig's
right?
disease, okay. Yeah.
And so how long was he sick? For years?
About 5 years, yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. And it's slow, you know, it's sort of like a slow degenerative disease. And so it started off, he had just lost feeling and in his neck but in his arms, but then it progresses and it was also his legs, and then eventually your organs shut down. So he was on a ventilator and he was being fed through a machine and all this stuff. And it wasn't, you know, I think for most people that would have not been considered much of a life, but for my dad, he somehow managed to be really positive all the time and
really?
Cracking jokes with people and stuff. It was really inspiring.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he handled it gracefully.
Very gracefully, yeah. It was really cool for me to see that.
And so obviously when he did die, even though you were expecting it for 5 years, it still was a shock and earth-shattering. And you were living here. He lives up in New York?
No, he was living in Arizona, actually.
Okay.
So, yeah, and it was, it's just, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, I would just think, oh, you know, I need to know something. I'll just call my dad and ask him. And then it's like, oh, right. I can't call him now.
Yeah.
Not on the phone, so.
And they don't come back at all.
No.
No, it's really
so
fucked
final.
Up.
I know.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Well, this is really starting off on a really exciting.
Well, no, but the thing is that it made me really demand more of myself. Like,
if
I was,
mean?
I mean, that from that point onward, if I start to feel really sorry for myself or just really sad about things, I still feel sad, but I think, okay, well, look, you could be dead tomorrow. Like, you have a choice. You can let it go or you can, you know, like, just try and look at it. Like, if something doesn't go your way or you're losing something, it's really not the end of the world because you're only here for a short time and maybe, like, it would be worse to just be upset all the time and stuff. So
yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
And so, and then you broke up with your lover.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of coming.
So 70s. That word, I love it.
I know. But it's appropriate.
You broke up on your houseboat, didn't you? I'm sorry to
totally.
Make light of your life.
No, please do. It's much better than the alternative.
Good.
Yeah.
So it was coming for a long time as well, like your
dad.
It's
just been like a slow sort of dissipation kind of thing. But it still affected, you know, it just still affects you. You think like something's still going to turn out another way. And
right.
It's like, okay, that's not going to work out. And I think that, you know, and then there were friendships and stuff that sort of disintegrated. It was just like my hairdresser called it the people purge.
because I guess,
you know, a lot of people go through something like that.
Yeah. It seems to happen like, you know, a couple of times in your life.
Yeah.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
It really is. But it's also really inspiring.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so what did you just, were you writing during that time?
I started to.
Yeah.
Yeah. I basically knew that I was about to sort of finalize this, getting out of my record contract. I bought myself out of my record contract and left my old management. And it had, like, taken a long time. And then finally, I just got, like, really determined about it, you know?
So you just totally changed everything.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. But like I said, it was sort of, I just got this clarity, you know, after my dad was gone. And I mean, it sounds cliche, but I really thought, you know, my life is short.
Yeah.
And what am I going to do with it? And also, you know, my dad was struggling with something really, you know, physically debilitating and still managed to be happy. So those two things together just made me think, you know, I should just be happy.
Yeah.
And I should do what it takes to be happy. Yeah. And, you know, just try and go for it.
And also there's a certain, like, I lost my mom when I was younger than we are now. But when I did, it gives, there's a fearlessness that comes along with it.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
And it is. It's kind of like, okay. Yeah. Well, now I have to do something. You know what I mean?
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So where were you when you were writing the song? Were you on the road? Were you here? Were you?
I was here.
In Arizona.
I wrote some of it in Arizona. I wrote the song "Beautiful Child," which is on the album there.
Right.
Which is, I wrote that 2 days after he died or something, and it was just, you know, I was just in that moment where I, like, had no idea what to do, and I just thought, like, I'll just try writing and see what happens. But most of it I wrote last summer. I was home for the summer. I wasn't really touring that much, and I just gave myself a deadline, and I decided I wanted to tour, put a record. What are the things that I do? I'm like, tour, record. I decided I wanted to record in September.
Yeah.
And release the album, you know, around now or whatever. And so I just worked backwards and was like, okay, I have to have 10 songs by September, and I better do whatever I have to do to make that happen. And also, I can't stand the heat, so I just kind of lock myself in the AC every day.
Yeah. It's starting to get horrible.
Yeah.
So it's funny because when I was reading your bio, it talked about that you picked up and the acoustic guitar and started writing songs while living as a student abroad in Kingston, Jamaica, in your late teens. And your first songs reflected a bittersweet culture shock as well as the warmth. I'm reading this straight from a bio. Yeah. I wish I just spoke like that. You were influenced by your surroundings. A, culture shock. B, probably feeling alone.
Yeah.
Were you alone there?
Yeah, a little
and,
bit.
And you picked up music as a way to express your emotions?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So this album is almost like the epitome
of
that.
Yeah.
Jess Klein.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. Yeah, it's very, it feels the most me of any album that I've made.
Yeah. So where were you born?
Rochester, New York.
Yeah. And you have brothers and sisters?
No, I have two stepsisters, but from other marriages. So
okay.
I was, like, an only child growing up.
Okay.
Pretty much.
Are you close with them?
Not really. The step people. No.
No.
Not really.
Is that, what was your world like then? Like, as a kid? Like,
I was really into the arts, you know.
Yeah,
I was really into drawing and painting, and I played clarinet for like 10 years, and I danced. I was really into dancing. And I guess that I spent a lot of time alone. My parents were divorced when I was pretty young, and my mom was working. So I guess as soon as I was old enough to my grandmother watched me for a while, but as soon as I was old enough to watch myself, I just would go home and listen to music and, you know, dance around.
Yeah.
Just create as much as I could. It felt like a safe place, or, you know.
Yeah. It was an escape for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems to be like that for a lot of people. So did you have any aspirations to be a musician? Did you have any specific thing you wanted to be?
No.
Like a dream?
I had no plan. And I went to college, and I I didn't know what was going to happen on the other end of that.
What were your things in high school? Like, were you popular? Were you...
No.
Were
you... No.
I like you.
I hung out with the yearbook committee, you know? They That's were cool. all really smart
yeah.
and, like, funny.
Were you smart? Were you reading and, like, kind of, like...
I loved English class a lot.
Yeah.
I would just take, you know, tons of notes on my, you know... This metaphor means that I was really, you know,
right.
really into reading.
And when were you in high school, like that, in the 90s?
Late 80s, early 90s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when did you go abroad? During high school or when you went to college?
Where'd
you go to college?
Hamilton College. It's a little liberal arts school in upstate New York.
And did you have a major? Or were you just kind of like, I'll just go to college?
I started off major. I wound up majoring in women's studies, and I had a minor in creative writing. And you know, I think
were you like a feminist?
Yeah, but the strange thing was that it was a really strange scene at that school.
Were you like a? Sorry, okay. I remember those times, and it was like there was a lot of neo hippies. I was one of them.
Okay. Yeah,
yeah. I wore like tights with then like jean shorts over them, but like flower tights.
Right.
That belonged to some girl, and so not all the time. But like, I'm just picking out an outfit. Were you like this kind of like late '80s, early '90s flower child reborn?
I guess
long decade or something.
Yeah, a little bit. Like okay. All my guy, I keep saying like, which I guess is a dead giveaway. But all my guy friends in college did a lot of LSD. Stuff.
Did you get into LSD?
No, I got into pot a little bit, but yeah. I was too afraid to try anything really intense, you know. But yeah, we would hang. In fact, I had this sort of group of really close girlfriends in college, and we'd hang out with these guys, and we were so naive that we didn't really understand till later that the reason they would say crazy things all the time is that they were always tripping.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You gotta look out.
Yeah.
what was your degree? You had no major, or you did?
Women's studies.
Women's studies. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Tell me about this. So, why did you go into women's studies? Were you a disenfranchised woman living in a man's world?
I guess, you know,
at a young age, like I was like political like that when I was, when I look back on it now, it's so funny because it was like I was so earnest and like fucking like. No, Dukakis is awesome.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know what I was talking about.
Yeah. I was
probably going for the right guy, but
right.
I was so adamant and like.
Yeah, I was a little bit PC. But then this, maybe not so strange in retrospect, but at the time, even at the time, I noticed that the people, you know, in my classes and maybe running the department were just as bad, you know, they were so exclusive and weird about everything that it was almost as bad as, you know, the like fraternity scene or whatever. So,
how did you get to Jamaica? The weed?
Yeah. It was actually, that was really cool. Actually, it was a women's studies program, right. But it was the thrust of it or whatever was women in developing nations, and so it was actually really enlightening and educational, and the woman who ran it was really, you know, I don't know, I think, you know, the people studying women's studies at my college were maybe just in a PC world, but this woman was like actually doing things,
right.
When you say
that, like, what are they doing? Because that's always a big question, is this woman who was actually doing things, what was she doing?
I don't. I think that she, well, I
it was
mean,
like
for one thing,
mid-90s suffragette.
Yeah, she was. Well, for one thing, she was bringing students in and having people from the government, and you know, we'd go tour hospitals, and you know, we sort of saw glimpses of all, you know, all walks of life or whatever for Jamaican women, you know, like we visited with NGOs and we saw like, what are they're making, you know, crafts that they can sell so they can support themselves. And
right.
So it was, there was a little more reality going on there.
Hang on.
Okay.
I'm going to do something. It's going to be bad, but you're kind of peeking when you talk.
Oh, okay. Okay.
There we go. All right. So you guys were actually doing stuff and there is a struggle for women in that country because they are treated. There's a lot of, it's just kind of behind the times.
I don't feel like that qualified to speak about it now because it's been a long time, but
right,
I felt like I was really learning something and
right,
you know,
right,
yeah.
It's weird how just a few inches can make the levels just normal.
Oh,
okay. So what, how did you get a guitar? What, someone give it to you? Did you go get one? Were you like,
my dad actually had one in his attic that he hadn't used in years, and he had started off, he wanted to play guitar, but my dad was very anal about things, so you'd just hear him going like on a G chord, like
right,
you know, and after a while I think he got tired of
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
So I had started to want to learn guitar, and so he lent his to me. I brought it with me to Jamaica.
And so did you learn as soon as you got there? How did you learn? Did you take lessons? Did you?
I taught myself.
Did it come to you through a bong? Sorry.
There's actually a really funny story, maybe I'll tell you. But I actually started, I had learned a few chords in college, you know, in school.
Okay.
Like one of my sweet mates was really into the singer-songwriter thing, and he showed me some chords.
And were you into it then? Did you go see people and, you know, at the coffee shop or like at the, you know, did you have a friend that did it? And
well, the sweet mate guy actually started a series at our school, and he was bringing in all these songwriters who were really cool. You know, he brought in Sean Colvin and Patty Griffin and Richard Chindel. You know, he had his finger on the pulse of what was happening, you know.
Yeah.
So, he got me, you know, I kind of got into, I was like, oh, you could, I could write lyrics and sing and play the guitar and it would be, you know, something.
And so when you started playing in Jamaica and started, like, who was your, who were you listening to that you were?
The Indigo Girls. Must have been,
yeah.
A lot of the, and.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
I don't like them. And I went to a party. I'm sorry. This is an entertaining podcast, and it's not just all about you, Jess. I'm sorry.
No,
I've been dying to tell this story on this podcast, and this is like the 65th episode, and I finally get to tell it. The Indigo Girls. I went to a party, a Perez Hilton party, and man, it was like Beyonce's sister, and like all these cool people, and like Kanye, and like all this shit. It was during South by Southwest, amazing, but smack dab in the middle of like the gay like dance party of the universe, the Indigo Girls come on, and it wasn't because of their music, you know what I mean, it was just simply because, oh, you know, this is a you know, older gay people,
yeah,
you know, look at this, let's pay homage, and they killed the party, like they started playing and like all these people everyone starts getting in conversations, which is the worst thing because it's these two girls with their acoustic guitars and everyone was talking so loud, and I was just like I felt bad for them. I'm not a huge fan. So you were listening to the Indigo Girls.
Yeah,
who else? Anyone
I
else
love their music. There was a, I was really into this band from Boston called Knots and Crosses. Did you ever hear of this woman? Uh-uh. Carol Noonan. She had just really strong voice, so I listened to her. And I don't really know what else. Those were the first songs that I was trying to learn.
Right.
You know, and then totally drawing a blank. But you know, up until that point, I'd mostly listened to classic rock,
right,
and Motown and stuff.
Yeah,
because that was what was being played in Rochester.
Were your parents into? Were they like?
My mom.
Couldn't think of what they would. Were they like from the Big Chill era?
I guess so.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mom had, she had some really cool Motown albums, and she was into Billy Joel. And my dad had a pretty good collection, actually. He had pretty wide range, you know.
He had
like some Simon and Garfunkel, and then he had a lot of comedy tapes.
Yeah.
Like George Carlin and.
Yeah.
stuff like that. I'm not sure how that influenced my music, but
I think that stuff does.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm a crazy fan of that stuff. Yeah. I'm actually going to go see Marc Maron tonight.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at the Mohawk.
Oh, that's great.
There's a huge comedy festival going on.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, so did you immediately start writing, or were you learning Indigo Girls songs? Which, you know, the thing is I shouldn't have said I don't like them. It's not that I don't like them. That party just, it just weirded me out. So, yeah. They have these kind of, I talked to this guy, Kurt from the Bodines the other day, and when I was in high school, their first album came out, and there was something about a record that you could sit down and play the songs.
Yeah,
Was that what it was about that?
I think that was part of it.
Yeah.
For sure. I could sing the parts, and I could play the songs, and I got what they were talking about, and it was...
Yeah.
Yeah,
like, if you know chords, and you can pick out the chords, and you have, like, a Tom Petty record and an acoustic guitar...
Yeah.
You're totally set.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, you can figure out a whole record.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so how did you start writing? Did you write poetry?
No, I never wrote poetry. I still can't really wrap my head around poetry at all.
What about a diary?
Yeah, diary. A lot of diaries. And I was really into short stories.
Okay. Were they good?
They were out there.
Do you ever put any of that stuff? Do you ever think about releasing your...
the one that I remember writing...
I don't know. People release their memoirs.
Yeah, they do.
You know?
I don't know. You know, it might be like sort of like a diary where you don't necessarily want people to read it.
Okay.
But I did write one short story. When I was in high school, I worked as a cashier at a home improvement store. It wasn't Home Depot. It was like...
Mom and Pop?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
And I wrote this story about this crazy thing that went down after hours where the... They trap the last customer in the store, and they sort of torture him, and it was pretty out there. It wasn't like...
Did you have violent fantasies then?
No, it wasn't that kind of torture. Oh, okay. They just sort of taunted him a lot, and...
What do you mean, like...
They just wanted to scare him.
Okay.
And I don't remember how it ended or whatever, but that was probably the... best short story I wrote.
So when you started writing songs and stuff, when did it click to you that this was something you might want to do?
Right away.
Yeah?
Yeah. I wrote... Basically what happened was while I was in Jamaica, I started to write songs, and I was doing... We had to do a sort of in-depth project while we were there, and so I wound up interviewing these two women who were dub poets and another woman who was more of like a folk artist, and then one of them told me about this session where you could go... I had just started writing songs, and they said, oh, you should go audition for this thing, you could be the special guest 1 week, you know. And so I went to audition with my two songs, and there was like a committee that it was actually really intense. You had to like audition for this committee of Jamaican artists and and musicians, and it was headed up by this woman who's, again, I can't remember her name, but she was kind of like a really established writer, and then they decide if you can be their guest.
Wow. And did you pass?
I passed. So they had me as a guest, and I got to play my three songs. And Muda Baruka was there, just hanging out. Do you know who he is? He's like he's a really big dub poet. Like, he's sort of world famous, like really intimidating dub poet guy. But it was just, but as soon as I did it, I was like, oh, this really works for me. Like, you know,
do they like you?
I guess. I mean,
What was your song like?
Well, I had a song about my boyfriend back in the States that was, you know, like a sort of...
Oh, so were you in a long distance relationship?
Kind of.
An LDR.
I can tell it. I'm getting an LDR. I don't know. I don't know if it's the heat or my age or what, but like, I feel like I can't even like totally grasp the details of these, like... stories anymore. Everything you ask me, I'm like, maybe I don't remember. But yeah, I was sort of in a long distance relationship.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So you played these songs. They really liked them. And then with your newfound encouragement.
Yeah.
When did you come back to America?
A few months later. Okay. I was just there for a semester. And I came back and I told my parents this is what I was going to do. And
what was that like?
I think my mom was a little mortified. And my dad was like, cool, go for it.
But neither one of them were, well, at least now you have direction, because before you were just like, you know, drawing on the walls and stuff. You know.
Totally. Yeah. I don't know if they
having
saw it that way.
Having violent fantasies about your cashier job at the hardware store.
Totally.
So what did you do? You went back to Rochester? Did you go back to school?
Yeah, I still had another year of school.
And did you play while you were at school? Did you come back and tell Sweet Mate, like, hey, I'm here, I'm ready?
Yeah. I told him, you know, so he booked me in his series, and I opened for a couple of people. And then I would go and do an occasional open mic. And then I moved to Boston because some of the people he was booking were coming from Boston because there was sort of a folk scene, like a songwriter scene there.
Okay, yeah.
And I started playing there, and I just, you know, I had a job.
What was that scene? Did anyone come out of that scene that we would know?
Dar Williams was kind of around there, yeah. And Ellis Paul, if you know him.
Yeah.
Vance Gilbert, and I'm not really sure who else, but those were just sort of like the bigger names that were around there at that time.
And so what were you into at the time? Like, what were you listening to as well? Like, were you writing a lot and like...
Yeah, I was mostly listening to the other people who were playing at the open mics.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And we'd play together and see what we could come up with. And that was the first time I ever had a musical community. And I just kind of kept at it, I guess. And then I made an album, and it's, you know, it was just like branching out little by little.
Right.
It was like, then I would tour New England, and then I'd like get to go out to the Midwest.
Right,
and,
right,
you know.
Right. But it happened fairly quickly.
Yeah,
for you.
Yeah.
Because you're good, right? And you were obviously yeah. Started. I mean, I never heard anything until the first Ryko Disc record that you did, which is, I think, around the time when I met you.
Yeah, I think that's right. I would have been the first time I was at South By.
Okay. So on those tours and on those records, did you... Did you work with producers? Did you have bands on the records? Did you tour with bands, or what did you do?
I mostly toured solo, but I would have a band on the record. Mm-hmm. Ryko was really, really great.
Well, I mean on the first
album.
Two.
On the first two.
Those first two solo records that you did on your own.
Oh, on my own.
Yeah.
No, I pretty much always played solo, I guess. I started to play with a guitar player, and like I guess occasionally in Boston I would have a band with me, but mostly I was solo, or sometimes I'd get to bring my guitar player.
Right. And yeah. So how did you end up on Ryko? Like, you just stirred up enough of a buzz, or?
Yeah, the same. Okay, so the guy who was my suite mate in college.
Right.
He moved to Boston and started managing me. He was from Boston. So moved to Boston, started managing me. He was really ambitious, and there was sort of a buzz going on. And then he tracked down this guy, George Howard, who was running this label called Slow River, which later became part of Ryko, and George came to see me play and liked it. And so
and
he
then
signed me.
Wow. So it was just that fast?
Pretty much. I mean, I guess he signed me in 1999, and I had moved Boston in 1996 or something, so it was relatively fast.
And you put out two records in that time on your own before?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And you released them yourself and everything.
Yeah.
You sold them out of your car. And
yeah.
That was before the internet and shit. Like,
yeah,
what did you
totally.
Do? You put them in stores? Got them in stores? Did you get distribution on any of them?
I don't think so. I think I was just kind of at
and
shows.
And your suite mate then was managing you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we had this guy who would, you know, this guy would come and design flyers, and you'd send them through the mail, you know, go buy 500 stamps and
Send
out the postcards.
Oh, it sucked.
I know.
And it was so expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you couldn't do it from your phone at the gig.
No.
How weird is that?
I know.
So so you got on Ryko, and at that time, did someone, who produced that record?
George Howard.
Okay, so he did it.
Yeah.
And immediately you got really good response. Right?
Yeah, it got a really good response, yeah.
In the United States and Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what did you do?
I toured a lot.
Yeah?
Opening
for people, like who? And did you play festivals? And I guess that was right after Lilith.
Yeah. Yeah, there, I never got onto the Lilith thing, but I got to play like Newport Folk Fest and some Canadian festivals, and then I got to go to Japan and play Fuji Rock. And,
yeah, I saw that.
I toured in Europe with this band called the Willard Grant Conspiracy, who were also on Ryko.
Right.
And yeah.
How long did that sort of run go on that record?
Couple, maybe like 2 years, and then I did this project called Voices on the Verge, which
right.
is a terrible name, but it was really cool, and that also had its own buzz because it was four songwriters, but we were also playing different instruments on each other's things, and kind of it was a really cool live show.
Did you whip out the clarinet on that?
I did.
You did?
Yeah.
Awesome.
I did.
That's
yeah.
great.
Yeah, it was fun.
Okay, so, and you guys played on, like, Good Morning America, and what, did
yeah.
you guys make a record, or did
we
you?
We made a live record.
Okay.
Yeah. With
why did you guys do that?
Well, I think it was.
I don't mean that weird. Just,
no.
Like, legitimately, like, well.
Yeah, it was, we had done a couple shows together, and it just got this great response, and that was just at the beginning of the internet. People would tell their friends on the internet, oh, you have to go see right. this band, blah, blah, blah. And so we were riding that wave a little, and it was a little bit the height of the sort of Lilith. It was like same time frame as Lilith, and like Ani DiFranco had just gotten really big. And so it was this kind of girl power thing. And then the same guy who was managing me managed two of the other women in this.
Sweet Mate still.
Yeah.
He was.
Yeah. And so he, I think, sort of encouraged us to make this album and do a tour and stuff. And it wound up being on Ryko as well.
Wow. That's really cool. And
yeah.
Did it do well?
It did do well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It did really well.
Good enough to be on Good Morning America.
I guess so. Yeah.
What was that like? Is it cold in there?
It was 4 a.m. or something.
Really?
You show up and they put a ton of makeup on you. And it was weird, but it was great.
Did you have trouble walking down the street after that? Did people recognize you and shit? Like no. I mean, like, after you are on like a show like Good Morning America where a zillion people see you.
I don't think so, actually. I don't remember anyone saying, oh, I think I saw you on Good Morning, not on the street,
right?
You know.
So then you moved to New York.
Yes.
And you did your second record for Ryko, Strawberry Lover.
Yeah.
Lover again, man. You're so 70s.
Yeah.
Into
definition.
And it debuted at number one as the most added album at AAA Radio the week before its release.
Yeah.
And was given 4 stars by Mojo. And there was a plug in it in the magazine Parade, which a gazillion people said. And one of the songs was named the top 10 sexiest song of the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. by the New York Daily News. And
yeah.
So how was that? What, did more stuff, bigger shows, that tour and
you know, it was
number
I got
one.
A lot of really great press and stuff on that album and radio play, but I wasn't touring enough, or there were some other things in my career that weren't lined up right, so I wasn't really, I don't feel like I got to maximize that.
Right.
But on the other hand, a lot of people saw that press and know me because of that album. Like if I go to Europe, people are like, oh, I first heard you on Strawberry Lover. So it sort of paid off in the long run. But at the time I was just like, I'm getting all this great feedback, but
right.
where's my career, you know?
Oh.
Like,
sorry.
No, it's okay.
So where were you at when you wrote that record? If it was a more Yeah. Obviously a little more sensual, kind of like.
Yeah, I.
Like your lovemaking record.
Yeah, I guess I, yeah. It's always strange when people tell you stuff like, of like, oh.
Tell me, what do they tell you?
Oh, we like to put this song on. Yeah, yeah. Get down, you know.
How long is this song?
Yeah, really short.
Did you do any extended mixes for the lovers out there?
I should have, baby making mix.
Okay, so so you did, you didn't tour that much, and then you made another record for Ryko, right?
No. Strawberry Lover was the last one for Ryko, and then
I'm gonna fire my my people that do my research. I'm joking. Sorry. So the next record was
City Garden.
Okay, and were you living in New York when you did
that
as well?
Yeah, I was still living in New York, and that was a really raw record. Strawberry Lover is a little more produced sounding, and City Garden was much more. I think after Strawberry Lover, and it was like I felt like my touring career had, you know, slowed down or sort of lost a lot of steam, because a lot of time actually passed between the first and second
right
albums.
Oh, you know what? I had a question written down. Why so long? That was it?
Yeah. Well, it started off that I was just basically in a terrible depression. But that was a year, and then all this stuff happened with Ryko, where they changed hands several times. I couldn't get anyone on the phone who even knew who I was.
I hate that.
It was just crazy. You know, everyone has this story now, I guess, but
It's terrible.
My career, it was like I couldn't put out an album because I had a record contract, and no one was calling me back, you know? So you're kind of stuck. I felt really stuck.
And your manager couldn't.
Couldn't you seem get to through. Grease the wheels too much. And then we finally, you know, we had things lined up. Okay, we're going to make the album. And then it took 6 months or something to get the budget approved. And then they delayed the release another year or something.
Who produced that record?
His name was Mark Copley. He's a guitar player, lives in New York.
Okay. All right. So then when you went to go make your own record after the Ryko experience, where were you at? Were you out of the depression?
I had the experience of, okay, I'm not getting support from this label anymore, but I still really want to do this, you know?
Right.
And so I'd be going out on the road, and I was driving around in my car, and sometimes I was only playing for 10 people or whatever, but I got really fired up, you know?
Yeah.
And I just felt like, I don't care what else happens. I have to make music. This is what I know how to do. And this is how I feel. This is when I feel alive, is when I'm singing for people. So City Garden, the songs on that album were pretty raw. And I was listening to a lot of blues stuff at that time.
What was your point of view on that? Was there a sort of overall point of view on the record? Like,
hey. It was a little bit like, I think it was just more vulnerable than Strawberry Lover had been. It was, if I was angry, I really let it sound angry. And if I felt lost and scared, I really sounded lost and scared.
Yeah, that's cool.
I didn't try and cover it up too much.
And so you went out and toured for that record. Did it get the same kind of response? Were people waiting for the new Just Calling record?
Yeah, I think so. That one also got really good reviews, and I started touring more in England and a little bit in Europe. And I just felt, I don't know, I always feel the most alive when I'm on stage and stuff. So, and yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just kidding. So what did you do next? What was your next move after that?
After that, I did a live album. I was sort of starting to get burned out on New York. And because I would be touring all over, and then I'd come back and basically have to work a temp job to pay my bills.
Yeah, yeah. And plus it's the chaos when you get there.
Oh my God.
Not coming back and chilling at all.
No way. No chill. It was just like,
no chill, all bills.
Chill. And all this crazy, you know, I don't know, things always have to really sort of knock me over the head for me to get it. But it was, I'd been struggling in New York for a while, and then I had this 1 week where I was living with a couple, and they basically told me they wanted to live alone, and I had gotten some kind of thyroid infection, and I had like had a bad experience with this guy, and I was like, I have to get out of New York, you know, I gotta get out of this town. So I made a plan I had a short list of cities, and I was just thought, I'm gonna just check out these cities when I tour or however I have to get there. And I got to Austin a couple months later, and I was on tour with a friend of mine, the songwriter Jonathan Bird. Do you know of him?
I know his name, yeah.
So I had never really toured much down here, but he sort of brought me with him, and we had some days off in Austin. He loves Austin, and so he was like, I'm going to show you everything about Austin, you know? Right. And by the end of the week, I was just like, that's it, I'm sold, I'm moving here. Everyone was so laid back. And
yeah.
And we went to a couple shows, and it was amazing to me to see how excited people here were to be watching music.
Right.
You know?
Has that worn off yet?
Not really.
I'm just joking.
I mean, no, yeah, it's still great.
So then you moved down here?
Yeah.
And did you make a record with Addison then? Or
yeah.
When you first worked with him?
Yeah.
And what was that? How long did it take you to kind of like move down here? Did you have songs written? Do you have an idea of a record?
I didn't really have an idea. I had maybe two songs written, and then I moved down here, and there was just a lot of serendipity. I had no idea how I was going to pay for the album or whatever, and things just started falling into place, and right. I knew who I wanted to work with, and it was kind of a crazy move. I didn't really have any money saved up, you know. I just came down here with like no money or whatever, and just things worked out.
Yeah,
you know, and people were so generous here. I didn't have a car; people would drive me around. You know, it was really. I was like, I'm home. I found my tribe. Right, right. You know.
Good.
Yeah.
And so you made that record, and what happened with that when you put it out? That was just a couple years ago, right?
Yeah, that came out in 2009, I think. And I think the coolest thing that came out of that album was that I got to meet and play with a lot of people here. I just got wound up collaborating with all these great musicians here and sort of... maybe also just absorbing the music here.
Yeah.
That sort of influenced the album and then allowed me to just do more of that afterwards because people had heard my name or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, so then you went out and toured and you came back and did, and you had a hellacious 2011. Were you touring last year during all of that and stuff?
Or
were
not you... a ton, no.
It's interesting, though, that you went right in and made a record, you know, after all that stuff happened just, you know, a few months afterwards. That's a good sign of a true artist.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. And so this record just came out 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, that's right.
Behind a Veil.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Like, was there a veil?
It means...
involved?
It
Are
means...
Are you Muslim?
No.
Sorry.
No, it basically...
I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. It's really... I mean, what it means is that I feel that I revealed my real self on this album more than past albums.
That's good. Well, I listened to the album a couple of times today, and it's amazing.
Thank
you. It's really
you.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you're about to go out on tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk to me about this. That way people will know that you're coming.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Going to the Midwest... for about 2 weeks, and I'm gonna bring my guitar player Billy Masters, who lives here now. He used to live in New York, and played on the album.
Uh-huh.
And then
I think I met him. I think I jammed with him even.
Maybe
was he playing with Mark at those Whip-In things?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
He's really nice and really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So just you and him.
Yeah, we're gonna just play together in the Midwest, and then in the Northeast. Mark and our drummer, JP, will fly up and meet
us. Oh, good.
Yeah.
So how long is the tour? And you're going, you start in Minnesota?
We start in Minnesota.
So we're
May
9th. Okay.
In Duluth.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a long story, but I was supposed to play there in the fall and it got messed up. So But yes, Duluth, and we end in DC.
And
end like of May.
You're playing in Cleveland?
Yes. Okay, Duluth. Sorry.
She's playing Duluth, Cleveland, and DC. It's going to be about a month.
A lot of days off in between. Duluth, St. Paul, Fort Atkins, Wisconsin, Ann Arbor, Cleveland, Chicago, Pittsburgh. I don't know if these are in order. Another place in Ohio.
So people can find you at jessklein.com.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could have said that.
Okay.
I'm just joking. Is there anything that I'm missing here? Is there anything, any funny? What, you were going to say something about something.
Oh.
Maybe I'll tell a story about that.
Oh,
then
yeah.
You moved on.
Yeah, this is not.
I've been waiting for the story still.
Okay, so the story was, I'm in Jamaica on this study abroad program.
Right.
And
it's really, really not the word you should use when you're majoring in women's studies, right?
Totally. Sorry. Study the broads program. My friend, I had told you I don't do LSD and that stuff. And then
right.
My friends kept saying, oh, we want to see what you're like when you're really stoned, you know, all that. So we're, most of the semester we were based in Kingston. Uh-huh. And then we got 3 days off or something, and we went up to Ocho Rios, which is a resort, you know.
Yeah, I stayed there.
Yeah. And everyone kept telling us, you know, don't buy pot here because, can I talk about this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't. I love that. Yeah.
Don't buy pot here because they lace it with stuff to mess with the tourists. And my friends disregarded that and went out and bought some pot brownies from some guy on the street and brought them back. And I tried one, and it was 3 days of me just barely functioning. Like, I was shaking. I thought I would try and talk, and it would come out like I was not, like, shaky, like old lady, like it was nuts. And I could hear my friends saying things like, maybe we should take her to the emergency room. And I would try and turn around to look at my friends saying that. And it was like, I mean, it was just so out there. I have some pictures from those 3 days. So that's why I don't do anything like that, because it just, my system is a little.
I owe my ex-wife an apology.
Why?
Because when we first went there, that's what she said. She said, this is laced with something. And I said, no, you're just crazy. We're just in Jamaica. And she said, no, it's laced with something.
Yeah.
I'm seeing things.
Yes, totally. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, shit, that's a good story. What did you see anything wild? I mean, did you eat anything weird? Like, were you like eating sand and thinking it was like a beautiful, you know, fish dinner?
I don't think so. I mostly remember being afraid to go to sleep. And I remember we were sitting at this outdoor bar when it first happened, and this guy was just also at the bar, had been talking. And I first noticed something was amiss when all I could think in my head was, he's talking three different languages.
Whoa.
And then it commenced.
Okay, so yeah. On that note, well, so people should come see you on this tour.
Please, yeah.
In the Midwest and in the East Coast.
Yeah, and I'll be back in Austin in June playing Thread Girls, but I don't know what date.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then do you have any plans after that? You're going back to Europe or?
I'm definitely going to go back to Europe next year. Hopefully we'll be in England and Ireland in the fall.
Okay.
And I don't really know what the rest of the summer is, but I can't.
All right.
Yeah.
Man, I hope you have a good summer, man. Call me when you get back. Thank you so much, Jess, for coming down.
Thank
You're
you.
Very, I'm really glad we got to sit down and finally talk.
Likewise.
I like you.
You're right. In an empty house. You're feeling all alone. You're quiet as
all right. It's my new friend, Jess Klein. That was really nice of her to come over, and I love her new album. I hope that you you can check it out, Behind a Veil. I'm going to play another song from it in a second. Just before I play that song, I have to remind you that this Sunday, April 29th, live How Did I Get Here podcast recording, my guest will be Danny Malone, 7 p.m. If you're in Austin, come down, Hotel Vegas, 1500 East 6th Street at 7 p.m. I'll be interviewing Danny Malone, and then he's going to play afterwards with the band. It's going to be pretty interesting. I've never really done that before, so you can kind of like learn about the dude and then watch the dude. So please come on out if you're in town. Do it. And remember, subscribe to us on iTunes. Like us on Facebook. If you have a phone, get the Stitcher app, and you can listen to us on your phone. You got to do that, you know, the phone thing. Everyone's doing it. It's the future. What? It's an app. Hello. I don't know what just came out of me. Here's some more Jess Klein. Thanks to her for coming by again today.
Has your world fallen? Scrambling on your knees, or is there something down there you should see? When you can't run away no more, is there still one final door? Which hides unseen room where the devil and his dogs or the angels wait for you. The beauty lives behind a veil in every trick you try, in every trial you fail. When you pray and away you exhale. Shake even more.